10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The History with Jackson podcast. Hello and welcome to the History of Jackson podcast, the podcast where we bring up-to-date historical research to you in an accessible and digestible way. So hello everyone and welcome back to the podcast, or welcome to the podcast if it's one of your first episodes. So today we welcome author, historian Raimi Targoff to talk about her book, Shakespeare Sisters, Four Women Who Wrote the Renaissance. Now I have just finished reading my copy this week. It has got a fantastically beautiful cover, but I think this is my advanced copy. And I am
It's
so
even more beautiful on the real cover, so we'll have to get
really
you one.
It really is. Yeah. You do treat me. So how are you doing today, actually? That's the first question.
I'm fine, thank you. I am in Florence, Italy, so I'm surrounded by great beauty and I'm happy to be here.
I am incredibly jealous of your surroundings.
It is raining, however, so let's not exaggerate how nice it is.
Well, a raining Italy is probably far nicer than a raining England, so I think I'd take that boat.
It might be.
So the first question I want to ask you, and I ask this for every author who comes onto the podcast, what was the inspiration behind this book?
Thanks for asking, and it's a really good question. I have been a professor of Renaissance literature since 1996. And only in the last 10 years, I would say, have I started teaching a course called Women's Writing in the Renaissance. And that course came out of a whole new field for me. In the last couple decades, women writers from the time of Shakespeare have been rediscovered. And I say rediscovered because actually during their lifetime, they were reasonably well known. And then they literally went under for somewhere between 350 and 400 years. So I started teaching this to my students and I realized how little awareness there was of this material in the wider literate public. So that was what inspired me to tell their stories and to bring these women who very few people have heard of unless you're specifically studying them to the public's eye.
I think that's a really nice way of taking a kind of hidden history and rediscovering it and bringing it out to the public. I think it's the kind of work that we need to be doing more of as historians.
Yes.
Now, within your book, you mentioned that you could have gone with a number of different women, but you've instead chosen four fantastic, remarkable women: Mary Sidney, Amelia Lanier, Anne Clifford, and Elizabeth Carey. What made you want to choose these four women for this study?
Yes, I want to preface this by saying there weren't 20 or 30 women I could have chosen among. So just to be clear, there were really a small number of women who managed to be writers during this period. And my title, Shakespeare's Sisters, is in conversation with Virginia Woolf, who imagined that there weren't any women writers of the period, that it would have been impossible. So Virginia Woolf was wrong. There were women writing, but she was right that it was very difficult to do that. And therefore, the number of women, when you think about the literacy rate being at best 10% for women, the fact that there were no schools that women were allowed to attend, women did not have formal education, all education happened at home, and a number of other factors like being married off at the age of 15 and having to bear lots of children and so on, there were very few women. That said, you're absolutely right. I would say of a pool of six or seven among whom I was choosing, I chose four. And the four I chose them both because they were writing in different genres. They were doing different kinds of writing, which we can talk about a little bit, and because they had interesting relations to one another. So they're overlapping stories. So the four women, very briefly, Mary Sidney, who was a great translator and translated David's Psalms for the first time into exquisite English poetry. Amelia Lanier, who was the first 17th century woman to be published, to publish her own book of poems. And I regard that book of poems as a serious feminist challenge to patriarchy in different ways. Elizabeth Carey, who was the first woman to publish an original play in the 17th century. And her play, which I think we'll be talking about a little bit, The Tragedy of Miriam, was a pretty strong response, to my mind, to Shakespeare's Othello. And then the last is the one who should be closest to your heart, Jackson, because she's a historian, Anne Clifford, who was a great diarist. She kept a diary on and off from 1603 to 1676, up until the day before she died. She was also a family historian. She wrote a massive history of her family dating back to the Norman conquest, and she wrote memoir. So in other words, we have a biblical translator, a writer of original poetry, a dramatist, and a historian. So we have four very different kinds of writing, and I thought that would bring nice variety to my readers.
I think the variety is a really nice aspect to the book, because you get to have such a wide breadth across and learn so much more about different disciplines, not only these women as well, which I really enjoyed across the course of the book. But unfortunately, across a podcast, and we also need to have something for our listeners to go away and listen, buy a book and read, we can only focus on a couple of the women today. And I think the first that I really want to focus on is Mary Sidney. I thought Mary was absolutely fascinating. So could you just let us know who she was and what her background was like?
Absolutely. So Mary Sidney was born in 1561, so just 2 years after Queen Elizabeth came to the throne. And she was born into a noble family without a lot of cash, is how I would put it. So there was some financial hardship in the family. Her mother was one of Queen Elizabeth's ladies of the Privy Chamber, which means one of her inner circle. She nursed the queen, for example, when she had smallpox, which left her, Mary's mother, disfigured. But the queen was okay. Her father was what we would call a high-level civil servant. He was Lord Governor of the Marches and Wales. He became Lord Deputy of Ireland. So he was working for the crown, but he wasn't titled. In other words, he wasn't an earl or even a baron. He was Sir Henry Sidney. So we're not talking about the highest levels of the aristocracy. We're talking about sort of low-level aristocrats from a good family, but cash poor. And I mentioned that and emphasized that because it was very important for her to make a good marriage and to marry up, as it were, which she did when she was 15. So at age 15, she was married off to one of the wealthier aristocrats in the kingdom, Henry Herbert, who was the Earl of Pembroke, and lived in a massive, magnificent house, Wilton House.
So you gave us a really nice, detailed kind of background on Mary's life, who her most important influences were, you know, the lack of money that her family had as a lower ranking member of the noble family or families. But one thread that I kind of want to pull out there is how important you've mentioned the role of being mothers and being daughters is throughout this book. Why did you want to pull that thread out throughout this book?
Because we need to remember, you're absolutely right, it's very important. We need to remember that women had no role in the public sphere during the period. In other words, they didn't have professional lives. They didn't travel unless it was exceptional circumstances. Their primary relationships were at home. And therefore, we need to always think about what the family circumstances were at home. And specifically, I think, the mother-daughter relationship, the relationship between them in turn, the daughter and her own children. If you look at the women whom I talk about, and let's talk about Mary Sidney in particular, how did she get to be so educated? How did she get to a point where she could translate the Psalms into the most sophisticated, complex poetry? How did she have good enough French and Italian, because she also translated from Italian, to do poetic translations? I can tell you, as someone who translates myself from Italian to English, this is no easy feat. And I have two very long and complicated degrees that got me to be able to do this. In her case, it was her mother and her grandmother. So she had a series of female relations who were extremely educated and who were committed to female education. Her grandmother was at the court of Henry VIII, and she was famous for being learned. She was a great early Protestant. And apparently she could discourse on theological matters. She knew multiple languages. She had, I want to say 11 children. I might be exaggerating, maybe seven, but two of them were girls. And those two girls, Mary's mother and her aunt, received excellent educations at home. Mary's aunt actually ran a kind of home school for girls who wanted to acquire more education and more sort of courtly ways. Her mother made sure that Mary and her sisters, unfortunately, both of her sisters died during childhood, but they had tutors coming to the house specifically for them. We have records of that. And one of the ways we know things about how much education girls got is from households like this, where we see Master Lodovic, the Italian tutor, was paid on this day. So-and-so, the French teacher, was paid on that day. So they were being actively educated. So when Mary's brother, for example, went off to school, he first went to the Shrewsbury School and then went on to university, she was still at home, but there were tutors coming to the house. And that was really, I think, thanks to her mother.
That dynamic of educating her daughters, but also bringing in tutors, shows just the value of education and how these women were able to interact with people who we don't necessarily think they would have been able to interact with.
Absolutely.
Based on our misconceptions.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, when we just look at statistics, it's very hard. And that's what, in general, we've tended to do until recently. We look at literacy statistics. We look at the age that women were married and so on. We don't know what was actually going on at the domestic level, how they were learning, what they were learning. You know, officially, women weren't supposed to learn Latin, but three of the four women in my book definitely knew Latin. So how did that happen?
It's a really nice point to see that we're bringing in those anecdotal evidence of women being educated, not only through the records, but then we take Mary and we take her brother, and she's involved her writing career based with her brother. Her brother has also written. How key of a role does he play in the development of her writing skills and her career?
I think he played a huge role. So she created a book of 150 Psalms that could also be used, honestly, as a poetry primer, as a book that just showed you everything that could happen in English verse. It was that kind of accomplishment. And to your question, you know, would she have done this if her brother had still been living? This was his project, but he got, you know, a third, or not even a third, a quarter of the way through. And then it became her project. So I think she very much saw herself as carrying out his legacy. And I think that's typical, Jackson, for women who might otherwise have been too discouraged or modest, or, you know, she was an aristocrat, she was a countess. This was a bold move, but she had the opportunity because of what her brother had left behind.
And the point there about aristocracy and her position in society, what role does a husband play in this, and how does marrying the Earl of Pembroke, part of the Herbert family, increase her position and ability to go and do these things?
It's a really important point. She obviously had enormous potential power as the Countess of Pembroke, living in an important estate. Some people have described the house she lived in, Wilton, at the time. They described it as a little college unto itself, a kind of salon where authors were apparently flocking to get her support, to get her patronage. I think it's a little bit exaggerated. I think most of the poets who were coming through were tutors for her children or were working with her husband. In other words, I don't think it was quite the literary salon maybe that some people have imagined it. But there's lots of evidence that she was sought after as a patron during the period. So many poets actually dedicated works to her, several of which bear her name, you know, the Countess of Pembroke's X, whatever it is. So the husband was key to that, because when he died, and he died in 1601, those poems stopped coming pretty abruptly. And her son took over as a literary patron who was sought after. Interestingly, even though the marriage sounds undesirable in lots of ways to her, she didn't choose her husband. She was 15, he was 38. You know, they didn't seem to have much of a intellectual connection. He let her do what she wanted, it seems, once she had the children. And I don't want to say he encouraged her, but he certainly didn't discourage her or shut her down. After he died, the house was no longer hers. She was the Dowager Countess. Her son married a woman also named Mary. So she wasn't even the only Mary Countess of Pembroke. You know, And for around 15 or so years, we don't have any evidence that she did any writing, which is really interesting. So in this case, unlike many other cases, being a widow seems to have been disempowering. Very often it was empowering, but I think the prestige, the base at home that the marriage brought her, the title, all of that contributed to her reputation as, I would say, the grand dame of letters of that era. And in addition to the magnificent psalm she translated, she also wrote a beautiful long poem to Queen Elizabeth, as well as a short play, a little pastoral play to the queen. So with the death of her husband and the death of the queen, she seems to have gone underground a bit. We don't hear from her for a while.
And then again, there's another interesting thread there. You know, we have Mary feeling disempowered, but Queen Elizabeth being that important figure within her life. And she serves Queen Elizabeth as a maid of honor in her household. She also attends Queen Anne's funeral as well. So how much of an impact did royalty have on Mary as she was one of those leading women within the aristocracy?
Absolutely. I think it had an enormous impact on her formative years. As you mentioned, she was a maid of honor, which just couldn't be more important. I'll just say a minute about that because not all of your, it sounds like being a maid might not be such a good thing. But basically, the daughters of the highest aristocrats of the most sort of favorite families in the country would come to court and serve as a so-called maid of honor. And this was like a finishing school, a royal finishing school. So they would entertain the queen, they would sing and dance, they would meet the courtiers who were coming through. They would travel with the queen on her trips in the summer. The queen would go out with hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of people on her so-called progresses. And Mary would accompany her. So we know that she went to Kenilworth, to Woodstock. She went on the summer progresses with the queen. So this was her real introduction to court life because she had grown up mostly in Wales at Ludlow Castle. That was her home for most of her childhood where her father was working. She was a little bit what in the US, I don't know if you use this expression, we would call a country bumpkin. She was a country girl and she came to London and all of a sudden, imagine at 13 being surrounded by the glamour and sophistication of the Elizabethan court. That's one thing to say. Secondly, I think Queen Elizabeth, who was herself a very gifted and really remarkable intellectual. She was a great scholar. She loved to read. She translated herself from Greek and Latin. She wrote poetry. So I don't think in general we give Queen Elizabeth enough credit for being as academically sort of oriented as she was. So Mary knew her. Her mother worked inside Queen Elizabeth's bedroom. So, you know, again, it's fun to imagine what kinds of things were being exchanged. Maybe they were exchanging poems. Maybe books were coming back and forth. We have no idea. But certainly she grew up with her mother's intimate relationship to the queen. And then with her own time at court, her husband was also close to the queen and had entertained the queen at his house. So I think the relationship with Queen Elizabeth was absolutely crucial. The relationship, by contrast, with Queen Anne of Denmark, I think was less intimate, less close. At that point, Mary wasn't such a big part of court life. Her sons were very involved with King James, but she was living on the outskirts, as I describe in my book. For a couple of years, she even went abroad and lived in Belgium and in Holland and took the waters at Spa and seems to have had a very good time. Apparently, she was chewing tobacco and shooting pistols. That's what we hear. So, you know, that was interesting. There was rumor that she was having a love affair with her physician, one Matthew Lister. So we can't verify that. But it seems she was enjoying being away from the court. So I think I would say for the first 40 years of her life, she had a very close relationship to the crown and specifically to Queen Elizabeth. And then she was somewhat distanced from it.
The idea of the court and what might have been going on between Mary's mother and those cultural and academic intellectual exchanges between those two. It's a real shame that we lose those. But now we've discussed the amazing and remarkable life of Mary. I'd like to switch across now to Elizabeth Carey. Now she's an absolutely fascinating character. But I want to ask, you know, who was Elizabeth and why is she an important figure?
In a way, her family life was the opposite of Mary Sidney's. Her family had no noble connections or ties. In other words, they didn't belong to the aristocracy. But her father was a self-made man, was a very wealthy lawyer, and managed to amass a great fortune. Elizabeth Carey was an only child to this ambitious lawyer. So two things happened as a result of that. One, to his credit, he decided to educate his daughter pretty much as if she were a son. And so he hired tutors. He gave her lots of reading. He was also responding to the fact that she was clearly a genius. I would say of the four women in the book, she was the absolute girl genius. Apparently, by the age of five, she had taught herself Latin, French, Italian, I think Spanish, and Transylvanian, because they'd had a house guest from Transylvania, and she managed to speak with this person and get quite fluent in the language. She translated Seneca's Latin epistles by the time she was 12. Remember, girls weren't supposed to even know Latin, so how did that happen? She read Calvin's Institutes, Calvin's big tome of theology, which most people can't get through. She read it again as a young adolescent and made a list of all the things she disagreed with and told her father. So this child was unbelievably gifted intellectually, and her father recognized it. So I said there were two things that were important to him. One was a positive, to nurture her incredible gifts intellectually. The second was to use her as a ladder into the aristocracy. So he wanted to marry her off to someone with a title, with the hope that he himself would then be elevated. All of that worked and did happen. He married her to a cash poor, again, aristocrat who was a lord. He became a baron, but he was not at the highest level, but he was, you know, quite from a quite important family and needed the dowry. The dowry was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the money that was given here was off the charts. I'm pretty sure it was 7,000 pounds in two installations. But, you know, this was a crazy amount of money at the time. And so she was married as a teenager, again, to someone who really was interested in her father's money and not in all of the extraordinary gifts she had. When her daughters wrote her memoir, and that's how we know lots of things about her, four of her daughters together, all of whom had become Catholic nuns. Remember, this is Protestant England. She had shipped them all off to become Protestant nuns. When they wrote her biography, they said that their father never cared for their mother. That's what they say in just very cool language, that he hadn't cared for her. You know, this was not a perfect match at all. And yet she had 12 children with him. So she was very, very busy nursing also. She decided to nurse her own children. And Jackson, this is one of these moments when you read the memoir that you realize, using our what we now know about certain medical ailments, she clearly suffered from postpartum depression. Her daughters describe her being severely melancholic and basically losing her mind, not able to eat, not able to concentrate, walking around in a daze after several of the childbirths. But they had no language for this then. They had no diagnosis for it. So, you know, she just had to suffer through it. Somehow, even with everything we've just described, she was a great writer and thinker and managed to publish several works. So the one work of hers that she's most famous for and that was published earliest in her life in 1613, so this is when she'd had a few children already, but we think she'd probably already finished the work before she started having the children, is her play, The Tragedy of Miriam, which is, to my mind, a kind of proto-feminist work in which the heroine, Miriam, is ultimately murdered for not obeying her husband. But the reason she's not obeying him is because he's a tyrant who has murdered most of her family, Herod, and he has falsely accused her of adultery. So rather than accept his terms and sort of just give in to her fate, like Shakespeare's Desdemona, whom I think she's directly responding to, Miriam speaks her mind. She refuses to listen to her husband, and she says she wants to obey her own conscience above that of Herod. So when a woman was married in Renaissance England, they were told that they should be three things: chaste, meaning loyal to their husbands, obedient, and silent. So Miriam is chaste, but she is neither obedient nor silent, and she pays the greatest price, her life. This was Elizabeth Carey's early work, but in a funny way, it anticipated her own story. And I don't know if you felt that, because, you know, 15 or 20 years into the marriage, she's converted to Catholicism while her husband is Lord Governor in Ireland, the same job that Mary Sidney's father had for a while. One of his main jobs is to suppress Catholicism. What does she do? She goes to Catholic Mass with the Irish. She starts worshiping in their churches, and she converts not only herself, but many of their children to Catholicism against his will. So that was a very bold move. And she says, I have to be more loyal to my heart and my conscience than to my husband, right? That, you know, I'll obey him in all little things, but that's pretty much what Miriam says, her heroine, whom she wrote 14 years earlier.
How does that marriage develop then?
Not well. That marriage really doesn't develop well. It falls apart. And actually, it comes as close to a legal divorce as you can imagine during the period. So her husband and she separate. They have what we would call a separation agreement, an alimony agreement. He's supposed to pay her a certain amount of money. This gets negotiated at the highest levels in the Privy Council. So at a certain point, she's writing letters to the Privy Council and to the king, King Charles at this point, King Charles I, saying he's not paying me what he's supposed to. And they intervene to try to get her the money. And he says she's squandering her money. They start having like these petty fights, which we know about because it was being conducted, as I say, through the highest chambers in the land. So they live separately for the last roughly 10 years of their marriage, completely apart. He doesn't want to support her. He takes some of the children away from her. She's supposedly impoverished, can't pay even her rent. She's living in a small house. But she seems, on the other hand, to be quite happy because she's doing what she wants to be doing, which is writing, teaching her children Catholicism, worshiping in the way she wants, and not having to conform to the demands of his very fancy courtly life. Apparently, she hated getting dressed up. She hated having her hair done. She should have just been a nun from the beginning. That's what she liked doing. She liked just reading, writing, being at home. And so that marriage ended very sadly. He then died around 10 years before she did. And they had a kind of reconciliation at his deathbed, apparently. But it was one of the messiest marriages that I've encountered in the period.
That messiness in that marriage definitely comes across, definitely through the way that you discuss their disagreements through the courts and having to speak to the various chambers and the various key nobles. It all seems very sad and messy at the same time.
Yes.
But within this discussion, a main thread that you're bringing through is her religion, her faith. And she has certain dalliances with different denominations, different sects. So how does her explorations with her faith come about, and how does that affect her writing and affect her relationships with others?
It's a really interesting question. Remember that as a young girl, she found fault with Calvin, which is quite unusual and interesting. And this is someone who seems never to have liked the Protestant faith. So during this period, it was mandatory that you attend church on Sunday and you would actually be fined. She was taken to task multiple times for not going to church. She didn't like going to church. So she didn't like Calvin. She didn't like the more Anglican form of Protestantism that was present in the Church of England in the early 17th century. And she got increasingly interested in reading the church fathers, in reading Tertullian, the early church fathers whom she associated with the sort of purity of the Catholic faith. How she first got interested in Catholicism, we don't know, but we know that one of her brothers-in-law had gone to the continent and came home with some Catholic works. So I would say it was through scholarly reading more than through, let's say, spirituality. She was a real scholar, and she was drawn to the tenets of Catholicism. Clearly, when she lived in Ireland, where there was a huge Catholic community, this became much more available to her, and she was really immersed in it. So after the so-called divorce, after the separation from her husband, she started to translate some Catholic French writers, and then she started to write some Catholic works of her own. And really the last decade and a half of her life was devoted to propagating Catholic faith in England. Now, this was a moment when things were really heating up. She died right before the Civil War began. But the wife of Charles, King Charles, Henrietta Maria, was a French Catholic princess. And Elizabeth dedicates one of her works to her and says, "I am most proud of two things, of being a Catholic and being a woman like you, my queen." So her tie to the queen was through her religion as well as her gender. And although her grave hasn't survived because the house was destroyed, she was apparently buried in Queen Henrietta Maria's private chapel at Somerset House, also known as Denmark House. So she had a very tight alliance with the queen through her faith.
That faith, that Catholic faith and conviction that she has, you mention within your book that it becomes almost a threat to Britain. How is that? This woman who's separated from her husband, who is writing in almost on her own in the house, not wanting to get involved in that aristocratic life, but she's a threat. It's a very difficult thing to...
At a certain point, she gets banned, exiled from London. She's not allowed to come within 10 miles of the court, you know, which was... She's basically put under house arrest by the king. And then he later says, oh, he didn't mean for it to last so long. He kept her in that state longer than he wanted. But the reason behind that is that her husband, or her former husband, is, as you say, representing her as an actual national threat, you know, her Catholicism. And that is because if it had just been this one woman who is a writer, you know, I don't think this would have been perceived as such a danger. But the entire country was very tense over the rise in Catholicism. All of a sudden, there was a Catholic queen who was sneaking Catholic priests into the house and running, in effect, a sort of secret Catholic worship series. So people were going to mass. You know, the Archbishop Laud was accused of bringing basically high church Catholic strands of worship into the Protestant church. So if the Elizabethan church was much more Calvinist, the Carolinian church started to look a bit papist from the perspective of people on the left, let's say. And remember, you know, we're about to see a civil war breakout that was caused in part by religious dissent, by the rise in Puritanism and Cromwell's distaste for the high church. And so, I mean, there are many causes of the civil war, and we won't go into that here. But what we see in Elizabeth Carey is actually the early signs of the fact that Catholicism started to spread. And interestingly, Jackson, it was spreading heavily among aristocratic women, heavily. So even the Duke of Buckingham, who was James and Charles's closest confidant, his family, several of the women in his family were accused of converting to Catholicism. So there was something in the air, as it were, you know, that was drawing them. And I link it very much to having this new queen. King James's wife, by the way, Queen Anne of Denmark, also pretty much became a Catholic, started off life as a Lutheran. So, you know, that was the second queen who had fallen into Catholicism, as it were. So Elizabeth Carey, as the wife of, you know, a significant, not the highest aristocrat, but, you know, a member of the aristocracy who was, again, a civil servant, was running Ireland, to have that woman publicly convert to Catholicism was something of a scandal.
And it just shows the network of influence that some people have, but also how much of a threat or an influence that some people in power can see. mothers and daughters to their power and the establishment.
Absolutely. And the fact that she wasn't content keeping her Catholicism to herself, but started to convert her children. The fact that her four daughters became nuns in France. I mean, that was unheard of at the time. She also kidnapped several of her young sons from their older brother, Lucius Carey, who was himself a well-known Protestant and an aristocrat. He had inherited his father's title and lands and estates, as well as his maternal grandparents' money. So he was quite wealthy. And Ben Jonson actually wrote a beautiful poem to him. He was a significant figure, Lucius Carey. He was acting as the guardian of some of her children because she couldn't afford to keep them. She really didn't have any money. She had them kidnapped in the middle of the night from his house, rowed down the river by two thugs, basically. And then they got shipped off to the continent as well. You know, so she was playing with fire at the time. And for that behavior, which I just described, she herself was brought before the Star Chamber and interrogated. And they wanted answers, which she refused to give them. So this was a woman who was really willing and able to stand up to patriarchy, to the courts. And I think some of that came from her exposure to her father as a very powerful litigator during her childhood. One of my favorite anecdotes that I would tell in the book, Jackson, is how when she was 10, she was brought to a witchcraft trial with her father, which was a weird thing to bring your daughter to a witch. It's like bring your child to work day. You know, she was brought to the interrogation of a very poor older woman who was accused of being a witch. And Elizabeth saved that woman. She's responsible for that woman living because she perceived that the woman was confessing to things that she hadn't done out of fear. So she asked her father to ask her a trick question. And the answer to that cleared her of the charges and she was let go. So that is an extraordinary thing for a 10-year-old girl to do.
And throughout this, the work that you do on Elizabeth, she comes across as devoted and ambitious. It's great to see her story alongside these other three women within your book. Now, I have a final fun question for you, as we do for all guests here on the History of Jackson podcast. Now, as an English professor, I'm sure you've read many a books. You've done a fantastic job at reading so many primary sources to build your book as well. But what is the most underrated book that you have ever read?
Oh my gosh, that I've ever read of any kind? That is a huge question. You mean not from the period, but just in general?
Yeah, just general in your everyday reading life. Doesn't necessarily have to be for work.
Okay. I would say this is an interesting question. For the first time last year, I read a novel by a woman named Shirley Hazard. So Shirley Hazard she died in the last 20 years, maybe even the last decade, but she wrote a novel called The Transit of Venus that was written, I think, in the early 80s, that I think is, forgive me to all those people out there who are going to be upset with this, I think is as good as Virginia Woolf. I think it is a brilliant 20th century novel about two sisters who emigrate from Australia to the UK. And it's such a powerful account of female internality, of marriages, of relationships. It's brilliantly written. I think every sentence needs to be read twice. It's that kind of thing. And for some bizarre reason, this book is totally obscured. It hasn't made it into the canon. So I read it last year because a woman at the New Yorker magazine rediscovered it, meaning read it and wrote a piece saying, like, I think I've just read this book four times because it's that good and I can't get over it. So I then decided I have to read this book and I was blown away. So I would say that that's my most underrated favorite book of the moment.
I think that's a fantastic answer. I really do. And I think discovery.
I want you to read it now and tell me what you think.
I'm going to have to put that on my Amazon wish list for the next few weeks. Now,
Good.
Talking of books that should be read, how can our listeners grab a copy of your book, Shakespeare Sisters, for women who wrote the Renaissance? And then how can they interact with you if they have any questions or they want to see your work even more?
Thank you for asking. So the book is now out in print. It was published in the UK on March 12th. So you can find it wherever you like to buy your books. I know that it's all over Waterstones and other bookstores in the UK if you want to physically go into bookstore, which is my favorite way to buy a book, but you can order it on Amazon or any other site. It's also available as an audiobook and as an ebook. So there are lots of ways that you can buy it, but my website is probably the best way to reach me, and there's a link to buying the book, and that's raimitargoff.com. I'm also on Instagram, hashtag raimitargoff. So you can find me that way, and I can answer any questions. But those are the best ways to reach me and to buy the book, I would say.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure a link to buy your book is in the description below for people to go away.
But thank
also
you.
A link for your website and social media so they can keep up to date with you and learn even more about your research. So thank you very much for listening to this newest episode of the History of Jackson podcast. I'm sure you can agree that Raimitargoff's discussion about some of these women who wrote the Renaissance from her book Shakespeare's Sisters was absolutely riveting. I learned so much about different disciplines, different dynamics between marriages and powerful female writers within the Renaissance period. Now, if you enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes that we have created here at History of Jackson, or any of the content through the blog or the social medias, please do consider heading to the Buy Me a Coffee profile in the description below or subscribing to History of Jackson Plus on Apple Podcasts. Next week, we've got another awesome episode lined up for you, and I know you're going to really enjoy that one just as much as you've enjoyed this one with Raimi. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll speak to you all next week.